Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Free Press Bunker at the North Carolina General Assembly, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Good to be back after a summer break. It is a Friday here in what are normally the dog days of summer, but indeed a busy day in North Carolina political circles. I'm Jeff Tiberi, glad to have you along. Your guest today is Meredith College political science professor David McLennan. Hey there.
Jeff, always good to be with you.
Welcome back to the podcast. Lawsuits over proposed constitutional amendments, ex-governors joining forces. There were new election projections out this week. Football season is upon us. Perhaps we'll get to that in a little bit. Let's start with these proposed changes to the state constitution. Listeners will remember there were six questions that were approved by lawmakers earlier this year. Voters would need to approve those. That is, of course, if they see all six of these questions. Challenges to four of the six are pending in state court. What was the most compelling argument you heard this week?
Well, you know, the basic argument by the legislative attorneys was that this is the purview of the legislature to put forward the constitutional amendments and to do the language surrounding it. But with the five ex-governors as well as current Governor Cooper, the argument is, it's fundamentally anti-state constitution to remove powers away from the governor. So it's a very interesting balance of powers situation in court that for those of us who spend their time teaching and studying these things, it's a fascinating discussion. For the average citizen, I think it's very confusing because they've heard maybe about these six constitutional amendments and are wondering, why in the world is there so much discussion around these things that we're not sure what is contained in each?
Right. All right. So real six, the six, we're going to set two off to the side. One constitutional question that deals with victims' rights, another that deals with really codifying or strengthening the ability to hunt and fish in the state. Those are not in question. The four that are being challenged, one would lower the maximum state income tax to 7%. Presently, lawmakers couldn't lift our state taxes above 10%. One question would lower it to 7. Another question would mandate voter identification at the polls. Exactly the details of which identification are major lingering questions here. So those are two of the remaining four. And then the other two questions that could go before voters have to deal with executive powers. One would put the legislature in control of filling judicial vacancies. That's largely done by the governor now. I believe it's been done that way for about 100 years.
Yeah.
And the other one, I read it as the most significant, but I want you to tell me which you read as the most significant potential change to the state constitution would be changing appointment powers to commissions and boards from the governor really to the legislature.
Well, that one to me is the most significant because I think we need to understand that even though there are 372 state boards and commissions, some of them are advisory, which means they just offer advice to the legislature or the governor about various specific issues. Some are what are called licensing boards, mm-hmm. which have to do with particular professions.
Can you give us a couple of examples?
Electrolysis, nursing, that sort of thing. But there is a select number of boards and commissions that are referred to as power boards. They actually have all the authority of a legislative body without being elected officials. So they can set utility rates, insurance, they affect insurance rates, they deal with transportation. You know, these big high-profile boards, the university system is considered to be a power board that have really some important powers. And, you know, we've had a system by which the governor has been generally appointing most of these, if not all of these, depending on what particular year we're looking at. And again, we've had this, these powers have been written in the Constitution for a long time. We've had Democratic governors, Republican governors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This would remove the governor's ability to have the major appointing powers to these 11 power boards in particular, but also the other 300 plus boards and commissions. And again, it's the question of balance of powers. We have, compared to the other 50 states in the country, a governor that doesn't have as much authority as some other governors. And removing ability to appoint judges or ability to appoint boards and commission members pretty much strips the governor of what remaining powers he has.
That I guess that dovetails nicely into my next question, or perhaps I'm just being redundant. Literally, what I've got down in front of me is, these changes would definitively make North Carolina's governor the least powerful in the country. Yes?
It would be very close. I mean, remember, we've only in the last 22 years given the governor veto power. So I think if you remove the veto power, you could definitively say that the governor would be the weakest in the country. This is not really related to the constitutional amendments, but, you know, during the Governor Cooper's administration, it's the first time the General Assembly is taking on its power to approve his appointments to his cabinet level mm-hmm. positions. So the legislature is involved already in a lot of what the governor has historically done. So these constitutional amendments, if they're passed and if they're upheld, would essentially give the governor ceremonial power, which the governor does have quite a bit of, the ability to do things with the National Guard, things like that. But in terms of legislative and sort of the running of government, he'd be very limited, or she in the future would be very limited.
Sure. There was a time as well, I just want to note historically, that the legislature did appoint the governor of this state up until 1835. I don't know if we're headed back in that direction yet, but I guess at this point anything is possible.
Well, if you had asked me this 8 or 9 years ago, if we would see a significant weakening of the governorship, I would have probably said no, because, you know, the governor is already not particularly strong. But, you know, what we've seen over the past 8 or 9 years is a systematic weakening of the governor using legislative authority to basically have oversight over the governor, which, again, for those who really understand the federal system, you know, it's the legislature controlling the executive branch, which is almost the opposite of what we're seeing at the federal level.
And in the short term, I think that a lot of people look at this and they think about just the dynamics in play, Republicans holding supermajorities here, a Democrat winning, and they will point this out very quickly, a Democrat narrowly beating a Republican incumbent for the executive mansion. But that's the short-term play. 10 years from now, we may very well have Democratic majorities in one or both of the chambers here, and we could have a Republican governor again. So this could be turned on its head in a longer term snapshot.
Which is, you know, again, brings up the five former governors mm-hmm. who have been part of this pushback. You know, there are two Republican governors, Governor Martin and Governor Holzhauser, who, you know, served at least part of their terms with Democratic control in the legislature and seemed to function fairly well. You know, I think we've just seen a real breakdown in terms of good governance in the state because of this back and forth between the executive and legislative branches about power and the use of power. So, and consequently, you know, the result of this, which is not surprising to your listeners, is lawsuits. Just, you know, we have an unprecedented number of lawsuits between the two branches of government.
Governor Easley was one of the five who took to the podium on Monday at the old state capitol. Governors Hunt, Martin, Easley, McCrory, and Perdue, swapped the chronological order there at the end, all spoke out against two of these proposed constitutional amendments, not dealing with, you know, the partisan aspect of it, but really dealing with the power component of this. And to your point about lawsuits, former Governor Easley just talked about, well, yes, there might be litigation going on now. If these questions move forward, if they're approved, this is going to be held up. This is going to be challenged in the court for years. Let's transition a little bit and interested in what you took away from that press conference on Monday. We heard the words unprecedented pretty frequently in various media reports. Realistically, what kind of impact are five former governors who are talking in kind of the dead of August, almost 3 months before an election, kind of impact do you expect them to have here moving forward?
Well, realizing that most citizens are not necessarily steeped in these six constitutional issues here 3 months plus before Election Day, you know, I think their press conference in and of itself might not register much in terms of the public. But I think what it shows is that the anti-constitutional amendment folks have already started their work. And I don't think it's the last time we'll see one or more of those former governors speak out. And so it could lead to a concerted effort to defeat one, two, or all of the constitutional amendments. It is significant in that, you know, these are, you know, it's a bipartisan group of former governors. Right. I mean, that in today's environment is significant in and of itself.
Speaks for itself, yeah, to some extent.
And again, you know, these are, some of these are, you know, huge names in North Carolina 20th century, early 21st century history. I mean, when Jim Hunt speaks, it tends to capture some attention, but also Jim Martin and Jim Holzhauser, him being the first two Republican governors since Reconstruction. It is significant.
I want to get your take on Governor McCrory, the 74th governor who ran in 08, lost narrowly to Bev Perdue. We'll attribute part of that certainly to the wave of President Obama, then Senator, candidate Obama, whatever. In 2012, McCrory thumped Walter Dalton to become the next governor, and then 2 years ago, he was defeated narrowly by Roy Cooper in this historic 2016 presidential election. It struck me that on Monday, McCrory was talking a little bit less about the functionality and the separation of powers in the executive branch and a little bit more about Pat McCrory. And I don't offer that as a criticism as much as he's only 61, which in political years I believe is pretty young. It felt like a stump speech to some extent to me. And as a political scientist, as we look ahead to 2020, we got a tweet from Dan Forrest, who's the Republican lieutenant governor, all but assuring us, and we've expected this for a while, but all but assuring us on Thursday that he's going to run for governor in 2020. Strikes me that the Republican Party has, call it a problem, a challenge, an issue. What do they do with this?
It's tough, you know, because, you know, many pundits, including myself, would say the reason they're putting forward so many constitutional amendments and the ones they're putting forward is to drive voter turnout for 2018. Now, the governor's race is not till 2020, but former Governor McCrory has never shut the door on running again. And so now we have not only the potential, you know, lineup of McCrory and Forrest seeking the Republican nomination, but they're on opposite sides of the constitutional amendments. So it even adds more fuel to the fire, creates more, you know, interest, to call it that, among Republicans to say, okay, we already knew these two were different kind of Republicans. Now they're really differing greatly on some pretty major issues.
I guess a couple, respond to these if you'd like. Seems to me like Forrest, who has raised a lot of money, would be better suited to win a primary. Seems to me like McCrory may be better suited to win a general. Seems to me also like Republicans, at least a lot of the ones I talked to within this political bubble in Raleigh, and maybe that's not the best snapshot, are really sick of the former governor. Is there an obvious, as a political scientist, is there an obvious play here about how to handle 2020? Is there a candidate that is most palatable to R's and conservatives across the state?
Well, I think you laid it out quite well. I mean, the typical primary voter is more conservative than the general election voter. I think it really creates a lot of awkwardness because even though former Governor McCrory did lose in 2016 and had a number of issues like HB2 hung around him, which continued to be unpopular. You know, the fact that he did win in 2012, you know, even though President Obama lost the state in 2012, you know, it was still perceived as a good victory for Republicans. He did have some victories in North Carolina. I mean, he did use the expression Carolina comeback, mm-hmm. and people see that, you know, he did work with the legislature on that. So he's not an entirely, he's not the kind of candidate that you have to write off and say he could never win in 2020.
Sure.
He appeals to a different side of the Republican Party than does Forrest. But, you know, this is, you know, as they're thinking ahead to 2020, assuming that President Trump is going to run for re-election and be on the ballot, the last thing they need is, you know, a difficult primary in March of 2020.
You think something could happen? Trump might not be there in 2020? I'm being facetious.
Who knows? A whole other podcast.
We might have. You're right. David McLennan, your guest here on the WNC Politics Podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at David B. McLennan. I want to chat with you a little bit about these U.S. House races. Cook Political Report and 538 had some new bits of analysis out this week. The 9th Congressional District, which is effectively an open race between Democrat Dan McCready and Republican Pastor Mark Harris, it's really a coin flip at this point. In the 13th, first-term Congressman Ted Budd is being challenged by Democrat Kathy Manning. It looks like that's still leaning R. I think 538 gave him a 62% chance at victory. And then the 2nd Congressional District, incumbent Republican George Holding, challenger Linda Coleman, a Democrat. The forecasts have this as firmly R, but I talked to at least one analyst who is trying to, you know, get us to frame this as it is a little bit more competitive. We can get into any of the three individual races if you'd like, but I guess big picture as we ease into it, what did you take away from this week? What is most newsworthy and noteworthy?
Well, I think the open seat election down in the Mecklenburg County area, the McCready Harris race, is, you know, once Pittenger lost and we didn't have an incumbent, open seat races are always interesting. There's been money on both sides coming in. You know, it's just a hotly contested race. You know, the 13th district, the way it's drawn, shouldn't be competitive, but Ted Budd is not a well-known person, and then the Democratic opponent, Manning, is a good fundraiser. You know, I'm a little less optimistic about the 2nd District's opportunity to flip, but everything in this election cycle is framed around what is the blue wave going to look like. Is it a ripple or a tsunami? I tell groups that I speak to that if two of those seats go Democrat, if 13 and 9 go Democrat, for example, we're seeing a 60-plus seat kind of swing in the U.S. Congress.
And that is, to be clear, very significant.
Very significant, historically significant. You know, if everything goes according to the way, you know, the traditional people like the Cook Report predict, you know, North Carolina could keep its same congressional delegation and still, the Democrats could pick up the 23 seats they need to take over Congress. So North Carolina would be a barometer for the size of the Democratic wave.
You were a much younger man. You're still a relatively young man. You were a much younger man in 1994. Does this election, somebody commented to me recently that this midterm reminds them of 1994. Any parallel there for you or no?
I tend to look at it a little bit more like 2006, 1994, you know, you had, you know, Bill Clinton in his first term. I mean, he was personally more popular than his policies.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, his attempts at health care reform were, you know, caused the Democrats to lose a lot of seats. You know, 2006 is a little bit of a different kind of election to compare to. We had, at that point, George W. Bush was personally very unpopular.
Right.
Iraq War, Afghanistan War, and that sort of thing. The economy was going reasonably well. And again, that's 2 years before the crash.
Right.
So Democrats picked up a lot of seats. So I think, again, we can go back in history and look at previous elections and kind of say it looks more like X or Y. But this one has dynamics that I think are unlike almost any previous election. Again, just the sort of the president we have in Washington driving things. You know, we've just seen some evidence to this point about the Democratic strength. And we have such a different Republican Party in terms of what they stand for now. I mean, 2006 and 1994 were... You could go down the list of issues and say this is what Republicans stand for. Now, you know, tariffs, things just kind of are different.
To this point, you wrote a piece recently that appeared in Real Clear Politics. The title of it was Anti-Clinton Women in 2018. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, we've seen a lot of women running. That's no surprise to most of your listeners in 2018. But if we look at some of the faces, and I mean both literally and figuratively, of the Democratic Party, we don't see a lot of establishment Democratic women as first-time candidates. we see someone like Ocasio-Cortez up in New York and Stacey Abrams in Georgia, the gubernatorial candidate. These are people that 2, 4, 6 years ago, you would have said no way they could have gotten their nomination. An African-American woman in Georgia running for the Democratic.
Well, and I think maybe also just at 6 years ago, Ocasio-Cortez might have been in college because she's like 20,
yeah,
29,
right? Yeah, she's super young. Right. So they wouldn't have done it, but no one that was like them could do it. I just think it's a sign of where the Democratic Party is going. It's a lot of, I think, what the excitement around it and also the challenges around the Democratic Party are that it's a sea change in terms of what the party is about. It's sure. No longer the party of Clinton. It's the party of the Ocasio-Cortezes and Abrams and people like that.
But is it also a party that really can encompass this much larger spectrum? So if we think about Ocasio-Cortez in Queens and the Bronx, mm-hmm. who's a Democratic Socialist, and at the same time we think about Dan McCready, who, let's just say for conversation's sake, does win the 9th Congressional here in North Carolina, a district that's R+9, is that viable long-term, or does this point toward a centrist bubble, a centrist party, something else emerge? Like,
yeah, that's the play. That's the issue, is where do moderates go? I mean, even if, say, both were to win, you know, then the first major thing they do when they get to Congress, they have a speaker fight.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's being played out in congressional campaigns.
We're seeing the 13th,
we're
right?
seeing the 13th. Yeah. You know, where do you stand on Nancy Pelosi is one of the primary driving questions of the campaign. So I think the Democrats will find that it's not just the Republicans who are finding it difficult to be Republicans in the Trump years. It may be difficult in post-2018 for Democrats to embrace both a McCready and an Ocasio-Cortez.
This is a throwaway question, and I will not be offended if you call me a clueless idealist. As these factions continue to strengthen, emerge, I mean, the Republican Party has moved to the right. I think any yeah. reasonable person can agree on that. And the Democratic Party, at least forces are trying to move it to the left. At what point, if any, are we going to see a presidential candidate like a Michael Bloomberg and a John Kasich emerge and run to? Are we going to see anybody try to run as an independent or come back toward the middle? Somebody of importance. I'm not talking about like a congressperson from New Mexico. Yeah. No offense to them.
Well, you know, I think I get this question a lot, particularly from the under 30 folks, because they're tired of the political parties by and large.
I'm not under 30 anymore.
But yeah. Well, I was going to throw you in with that group. But I think the difficulty is that the electoral system is stacked against, mm-hmm. you know, we saw, you know, there's a movement for the no labels party to run a presidential and vice presidential candidate last time and even in 2012. And they looked at the horizon and said, it can't happen. You know, for someone who's well self-funded like Michael Bloomberg, sure. I mean, we saw Ross Perot do that a couple times.
Sure.
You know, he made a credible attempt, particularly the first time. But it's so difficult.
But never won an electoral vote, if I remember.
Never won an electoral vote. Won 19% of the popular vote and never won an electoral vote. So we've seen, you know, times in U.S. history where parties have gone away and new ones have emerged. We don't have a Whig party, you know, post-1860.
Not at the moment.
Not at the moment. Good point. I keep trying.
And we haven't for 158 years or whatever it is.
So is it possible to see an emergence of a new legitimate party? Absolutely. What's it going to take? You know, it may take, you know, addressing some of the structural issues like gerrymandering and campaign finance.
All right, a couple of rapid-fire obscure ones to move us out of here on. What's one bipartisan issue that's something that cuts across all sorts of ideological corners of our current ring that you expect we're going to hear a decent amount about in the next 2 months, if anything?
From legitimate policy people or from politicians? From legitimate policy people, there are a lot of them. I mean, the opioid crisis. I mean, there's evidence that North Carolina, for example, is leading the country in most recent deaths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but in terms of politicians, you can already see it. It's going down the cultural paths, and whether it be, you know, something like the NFL or immigration, you know, I just worry that you know, voters on election day will have heard less about substantive policy issues infrastructure seems to have disappeared off the national radar, then we'll hear about Nancy Pelosi or Donald Trump or any of the other cultural issues.
You are a proud, if not semi-delusional, UVA fan. The Wahoos get going, I believe, in 2 weeks at home against the Richmond Spiders. How many football games will UVA win this year?
We will win at least the number we won last year, which was six. So 6-6 record. I think we'll win our opening game against the Spiders, which we didn't do 2 years ago.
Most challenging part about having a teenager?
You don't have that much time, but just certainly she started high school this week, just simply starting to think about the bigger issues, driving, dating, paying for college, etc.
Deep breaths.
It's there.
David McLennan, political science professor at Meredith College. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Always good to be with you, Jeff.
And thank you, as always, for clicking play to find out more about those proposed constitutional amendments and the litigation surrounding them. You can visit our website, wunc.org. Subscribe to the podcast, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher. We'll be back with you next week. For David, I'm Jeff. Enjoy your weekend.